Well, it's my pleasure to welcome you to this afternoon's panel. It should be an interesting, engaging talk. Today's session is sponsored by the Department of Philosophy and the Wisconsin Center for the Advancement of Postsecondary Education. I am not a philosopher, but I am an affiliate of WISCAPE, and I'm also the director of the Wisconsin Center for Educational Research. I'm Adam Gameron from the Sociology Department here at UW-Madison. And it's my pleasure to introduce our speakers for today. They are two eminent writers in the topic of higher education policy. We will have two speakers, and I will introduce them both now, and then they will follow one another in succession. Our first speaker is Sandy Baum, who is an independent higher education policy analyst and professor emerita of economics from Skidmore College. She's written extensively on issues relating to college access, college pricing, student aid policy, student debt affordability, and other aspects of higher education finance, including her books, Trends in Student Aid, Trends in College Pricing, and Education Pays, which were written for the College Board. Sandy Baum co-chaired the Rethinking Student Aid Study Group, which recently issued comprehensive proposals for reform of the federal student aid system. Her other recent work includes studies of college affordability and tuition discounting in public and private higher education. She received her BA in sociology at Bryn Mawr College and her PhD in economics at Columbia University. I'm not sure why you were led astray from sociology to economics.
Sorry.
But our second speaker is Mike McPherson, who is known well to those of us here at UW-Madison as the fifth president of the Spencer Foundation. Prior to joining the foundation, he served as president of McAllister College for 7 years. He is a nationally known economist and spent the 22 years prior to going to McAllister as professor of economics, chairman of the economics department, and dean of faculty at Williams College in Williamson, Massachusetts. Mike McPherson is the co-author and editor of several books, including the most recent, Crossing the Finish Line, Completing College at America's Public Universities, and he is the founding co-editor of the journal Economics and Philosophy. He has served as a trustee of the College Board, the American Council on Education, and president of the Board of Overseers of TIA CREF. We've got two seats right here. Two of you should come and sit down in chairs. Make that three. Mike has also been a fellow of the Institute for Advanced Study and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He holds a BA in mathematics, an MA in economics, and a PhD in economics, all from the University of Chicago. So let's extend a warm welcome to both of our speakers. And invite Sandy Baum, I believe, you're first.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's nice to be here. Let me first find out who's here. It looks like we have a lot of students. How many people are students? Faculty? Administrators? Miscellaneous other people. I don't know what I've left out. Okay. Thank you. So we have this very broad topic, which we're going to try to narrow down a little bit, the broad topic being ethics and higher education. And we're not going to speak in broad terms on this subject, but we are going to speak about some specific applications that we hope will get you thinking about how those specific applications have implications for other areas of higher education policy and other aspects of higher education decisions. We're going to talk about a range of things. I think usually when people talk about equity considerations in higher education, the most common thing to think about is sort of unequal opportunities and access to college. And a lot of us worry a lot about whether people with limited resources have the same opportunities to go to college as more affluent students. And that's obviously a critical question, but we want to broaden that a little bit and think about the decisions that students make and about the decisions that colleges make, and not about just about college access, but Mike is going to focus in particular on college completion. And we want to think about, in a time like the time we're in now, as this title suggests, when we know that everybody is struggling with limited resources, one of the concerns is that people sort of feel like they can't afford necessarily to do the right thing because their opportunities are so restricted, they just don't have enough money. It costs money to be fair, and we can't really worry about that in this environment. And that's a big concern, and we don't want that to be the dominant perspective. So I'm going to focus on the particular example of admissions and financial aid, it's an area where it's really easy to come up with topics that have a lot of ethical implications, and sort of use that as an example of decisions that colleges and universities have to make, and decisions that we hope get made in a way that keeps ethical decisions at the forefront. I think that we really have a tendency to think that it's expensive to provide opportunities to people, and therefore when we don't have much money, if something's got to go, that's one of the things that has to go. And that's not, from my perspective, acceptable. I don't think, however, that it's such a simple, the situation is not so clear cut. And one of the problems is that people who look at decisions like this, and this is true for other kinds of decisions as well, tend to think, you know, either you're doing the right thing or you're not doing the right thing. And very frequently, what looks on the surface like the right thing actually turns out, with further contemplation, not necessarily to be the right thing. So frequently I think people who are deeply concerned about educational opportunities and equity tend to criticize some policies and practices because they don't seem right, when actually maybe they are right. And maybe if you were to change these policies, they wouldn't necessarily improve the world or make the world a more ethical place. And so there are issues like the first thing that comes to mind, and I'll talk about this a little bit, but like there's a lot of controversy about, should we be giving financial aid to people based on whether they can afford to pay or not, or based on their academic qualifications, need-based aid, merit-based aid. And it's very simple to say, obviously, the purpose here is to give the money to the people who need it and not waste the money on people who could go to college anyway. Equity is clearly on the side of need-based aid. But when you look at it, that's not wrong, but it's not so simple either. There may be arguments for why the world will be a fairer place if you don't use simple formulas for deciding what's right and what's wrong. And actually, it maybe makes it easier to put ethics at the forefront if you realize that things are not so simple. The question of, can we do something about this when we're in bad economic times, or does this have to be something we have to actually be able to afford in order to worry about equity and opportunity, is not a new question. I mean, it's coming to the forefront now because of the economy, but basically, I actually wrote an article in the fall of 1998 about the balance, called the Balancing Act, and where at that time already it was like people were sort of saying, well, we have to choose, right? I mean, you're saying we should do what's fair, but wait a minute, if we do what's fair, that's very expensive, and then we as higher education institutions won't be able to afford to offer quality higher education to people if we spend all our money on being nice to people. So actually, it's not clear that we can afford it. We might risk insolvency. Not a new question, always a question that people pose. Certainly, and it's not just in higher education, all kinds of organizations pose that same question. How could we possibly afford to do this? But I think that getting away from admissions and financial aid for a minute, if you think about issues that are faced on college campuses are like a great place for ethical issues to come up, where there's some cause that sounds like a great cause and everybody gets behind it, or at least everybody who's interested in social justice gets behind it. And then there are always people who are a little bit uncomfortable about, is this really the right thing to do? But on the other hand, if you question it, you feel like, well, then I'm not on the right side. And I think it's a really difficult personal quandary for many people, but it's also the kind of sort of ethical ambiguity that it's important to grapple with when we look at some of the questions that are related to institutional policies. So I just came up with these two examples of divestment from weapons manufacturers and sweatshop debates as sort of thinking about some of the issues that have engaged people on college campuses. And so, for example, Let's start with the sweatshop debate. So how many years, 10 years ago or something, when you guys were all like little and before you were aware of anything, there was a big debate on a lot of college campuses, including Skidmore College where I was, about the problem. And it's still an issue that gets in the news occasionally, but you know, all of your sweatshirts, I don't know, see a lot of University of Wisconsin sweatshirts here, and I don't know who makes them, but the problem of who's actually making all this clothing, and you know, are we profiting off of the sweatshop labor in developing countries that we shouldn't do this, that we should really be thinking about who is making this clothing. And obviously, worrying about this issue is something that if you're interested in social justice, you want to worry about. But two different national groups sprang up to deal with this issue. And one of them, the first one, sort of was cooperative efforts of institutions and students and some of the sort of companies that were involved in the process. And then the next one was like, well, you can't have those companies that were doing these immoral things involved in this, and so we have to do it a different way. And it became something that was just a clash between these two groups, rather than, so the people who didn't care about it weren't even in the conversation, right? And everybody who was in the conversation, they all cared about this. But people got so sort of enmeshed in their own position that they weren't able to see that there wasn't one exactly right answer to the best way to approach this. And actually, I think it sort of did damage to the issue. But then people just wanted to walk away from the issue. But if you walked away from the issue, maybe you're not involved in social justice. Divestment issues, when I was in college, it was South Africa and apartheid, but more recently, there have been efforts on a couple of college campuses to do things like, you know, get the college to divest all of its, anything that's invested in a weapons manufacturer. So that sounds good. I mean, what do you want to say? Yes, please, let's go invest in weapons manufacturers. But then if you start talking to the students, and the students who are engaged in an issue like that obviously all have very positive goals in mind. I mean, it's hard to think of an evil reason why somebody would be involved in that. But if you start asking, well, does that mean, you know, what about is that all weapons? Do we just think that we shouldn't produce any weapons at all? What do we do about the world in which we live? What about, you know, companies who are producing, you can come up with a list of other things that they might be producing, companies that are behaving unethically even if their product is fine. I mean, have you really thought about all of the implications? Is this the right thing for us to be focusing on? And of course, if you wait until you have all the answers to that, then you're immobilized, you're not going to do anything, right? So it's not that you shouldn't pick an issue, it's that it's very easy for us to find an issue that sounds good and decide it's right and we're the good guys and the other people are the bad guys. So I think that, you know, just that we all realize that if we think about the big world, but it's sometimes hard to realize that when you think about some of the narrow issues that are involved in the decisions that are made on college campuses that have a lot to do with who actually gets to go to college and where do those people get to go to college, which is a huge issue, not only from an equity perspective in this country, but also from an efficiency perspective and the future of our economy and the future of our labor market. So there are like a few things that, like the issue of, you know, don't have sweatshops, sound like we should do these things because they're good. So need blind admissions, okay? So some colleges say, we are not going to look at your financial first of all, most colleges in this country take almost everybody who applies. So this is an issue that applies only to a small subset of institutions that can be very selective. And you know, if you're going to go to University of Wisconsin-Madison, you're sitting there nervously awaiting your acceptance because most people don't get in. But at most colleges, that's not the case. But in the colleges where it is the case, should you take into consideration whether people can pay or not? So the idea, if you just ask somebody this question who's never thought about it, do you think that if you have a qualified student who can't afford to pay, you should deny them admission? No, right? I mean, it's just, of course not. But it turns out that need-blind admissions is a much more complicated issue when it comes down to it. Need-based aid, I just mentioned as one that, you know, it's hard to say need-based aid isn't good. You don't want to help people who can't afford to pay. Meeting full need, if you have a student and you're trying to figure out, you know, how are they going to go? Like, here's a student from a family with no money. How are you going to help them come to college? Well, you're going to have to meet their need. You're going to have to give them the money to pay. How else are they going to come? So surely that's a good thing. No loans. A number of you may have heard that, you know, some of the richer and more highly selective colleges have made a promise and they didn't make it this year or last year. They made it a couple years ago before they realized where the economy and their endowments were going, but most of them have stuck to it, that if you come to college here, we will meet your need with grants and you won't have to borrow money. That sounds good too. All of these things sound really good. And the question is it okay just to say, let's do those things and let's not do the opposite and then we'll be fine? Or is it more complicated than that? And so what I want to do is sort of talk a little bit about some of these things to see if there's a way that we can engage with the greater complexity of these issues, but not throw up our hands about what to do about them. And I'm happy for you to ask questions and comment as we go. I don't have like an agenda of things that I must say. So let's start with need-blind admissions. Okay, so as I said, you know, there is this question of, you know, do you just take everybody or do you take money into consideration? And is it a yes or no question? So how is it, I assume that to most people the obvious answer is no, you should take the people who are the most qualified, don't worry about whether they can afford to pay. How is it possible, because we do have most colleges that are selective in their admissions, do, at least for some students, take their financial circumstances into consideration in the admissions process, not for every student, but for some students. How can we live in a world where this is the case? What possible motivation could there be for doing this? How could you possibly justify this? Anybody have any thoughts about that? Yeah.
I guess a college could say that we would want to give them opportunities that their peers may not have had. So they wouldn't be need blind then. They would be partial to over.
Okay, so that's a really good point. You're saying like maybe they actually want to give some extra like thumb on the scale to people who come from less advantaged circumstances. And that's a really interesting point because, in fact, certainly many people advocate that. There's not strong evidence that it really happens. I mean, if you look at the data and you look at, you know, what's the probability of getting in given your circumstances, I think there are institutions where they say, oh, yeah, we do that, but there's not strong evidence about it. But your point is interesting because, in fact, if you say that financial circumstances shouldn't matter, then how are you going to do that, right? Like, if you say, we are not going to look at whether you've applied for financial aid, we're not going to look, you could guess, you could say, well, you know, you can see from the essays that they write and the parents' occupations and so on, and you could guess, but if you're not allowed to ask, you're not allowed to ask. So you're suggesting that we might ask for the reason of favoring people, and that's an interesting point, yeah.
Sandy, I try and cross this with the idea of early admission. Okay. In other words, the people who apply for early decision.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an economist, as you know, you are, but I think early decision is an indicator of somebody who's ready to go there and to pay for it. So my question to you is, are need-blind admissions applied to early
decisions? So we could talk about early decision, which I think is actually, I'm not quite as definitive. Okay. Oh, I have to repeat the questions. The question was, what about early decision, and isn't early decision like need-aware admissions, sort of saying people who've already made a decision and can pay for it will take you first? So the fact is that I think at most institutions, I mean, we know that the students who apply early decision tend to be more affluent than the students who don't. That's very clear. But we also know that institutions who are giving out financial aid, it's not that they're not giving the same money to students who apply early decision. In fact, some institutions, it depends on their planning process, but they might give the most generous aid and then they run out. Yeah, it's not strategically smart to do that because these are students who really want to come. And so if you're trying to use your financial aid strategically, you might say, I don't have to give them very much money because they want to come. But in fact, my sense is that people are very concerned about that, and they don't do that, and there's not really any evidence that you get less money. The problem is that you can't compare, you don't have multiple financial aid offers to compare, although there is a condition that even though you're required to come if you get an early decision, if the money's not adequate, actually that's an out. So I think it's a more complicated problem than that, but the debate has been very powerful, and many schools have dropped early decision because of this concern. And whether that's right or not, at the same time that they're doing that, more and more schools are need aware in their admissions policies, right? I mean, more and more schools look, it's very common. It's not like you don't take any student who has high need, but if you accept 80% of your class, then you have a group of people who, you know, the fact is, as we know, there's a lot of arbitrary stuff in college admissions. And if you look at very selective colleges that are taking 10 or 20% of their applicants, I mean, it's not like the 25th percentile of applicants just wouldn't make it at that school, right? There's a big group of people, all of whom would be just fine, and you have to choose among them, and you don't have that much money, and you've already given out a lot of financial aid to all those people you've accepted, and then you get down to the last 20% and you say, you know what? We don't have the financial aid dollars to give out, so we're going to admit the people who don't need those dollars. And the question is there any, how could that be okay? I mean, what if you, I mean, is there a way to make that okay? Think of yourself sitting in an admissions office, right? And you have a finite budget, and you want to give each person as much money as you can to make it possible for them to come, and you don't have any more money, and now you have these people, and you could admit them, but you just really don't have the money to give to them. I mean, so like that's the choice that many people are facing is, and this is something that you could debate. Should I admit this student and say to them, well, we're happy to have you, you're qualified, but I'm sorry, we know you can't afford it, but if you can figure out how to come, by all means. And somebody might have a grandmother who will pay for it, right? I mean, one or, you know, a few percentage of those people will come, most of them won't come, right? So should you admit them or not? And if they do come, then for many of them, the problem is that they come and they borrow a lot of money, and then they get through 1 year, and then what are they going to do? And so there's a big debate about what's the right thing to do here. I mean, the best thing would be we have enough money to give all the students who are qualified the money to come, but what if you don't? It just becomes a lot more complicated what the right answer is, right? So you could admit everybody and then give everybody less money, right? That might be fair. But then nobody really has as much money as they need. So what's the right answer? I mean, the point is, I mean, it's not that I get distressed every time I hear about a school that becomes need aware. And I get distressed if they're becoming more need aware, like for 20% of the class instead of 10% of the class. And yet, if you have to make that decision, it's just not a straightforward decision which way you should do that. What is the impact going to be on the individual aid packages if you give out more of those aid packages? So, you know, that one's, it's just not that clear. The need-based aid question, okay? Now, as background for this, you know, here we are at a public university. The reality is that, you know, we think of financial aid from institutions as mostly private colleges are doing that, but public colleges more and more, well, maybe not more and more now in the last few years, but public colleges also give a significant amount of institutional grants. So you get your federal grant, you get your state grant, but also the University of Wisconsin gives you a grant and makes it cheaper for you to come. Now, there are a lot of students walking around on this campus who are really struggling to pay to be here. And yet, and I don't know whether this is true of the University of Wisconsin, but at many similar institutions, there are students who come from wealthy families who are actually getting a grant from the university because, why? Why would a public institution give a grant to a student from a wealthy family? Why can you imagine this happening at Madison? Why would they do that? What would the argument be?
Recruitment.
What recruit?
You mean? To get people with top qualifications to attend our university.
Okay, and why?
Because we want to rank high in the U.S. News and World Report rankings.
Okay. We might want to. I mean, that obviously that's a possible reason why we might do it. Yeah. Alumni Association check. It's interesting. We don't have really good evidence on what determines who gives those big checks, but it's not, I mean, if you take students and give them a lot of financial aid and create an opportunity for them that they wouldn't otherwise have had, and then they become successful, they may be as likely to give as somebody who who gets this merit award. But you're right, obviously people want wealthy students on campus for big fat checks. But more than half, I mean, this is pretty discouraging, more than half of the institutional aid dollars that are given out by public four-year colleges are given to students who don't need the money. So there's a problem. I mean, that seems like a pretty big problem. But the question of should you ever give money that's not need-based is, I think, a more unclear problem. The first thing is we talk about need-based all the time. And we talk about, you know, give it to the students who really need the money, not to students who don't. And it's easy to say, you know, don't give the money to Bill Gates' kid and give the money to a kid who grew up in a family where, you know, people are unemployed, on welfare, whatever. I mean, you can tell the differences in the extreme, but really, you got a continuum of people here. How are you going to really figure out how much money people need, and how do we figure that out? Are people familiar with how we figure that out? The FAFSA, that complicated form. And they ask your parent, like if you're between, you know, if you're under 24, they ask you about your parents' income. They ask you about your assets, but they don't ask you about your home. So if you think about it, and they don't ask you about your retirement assets, so they're not really asking about your assets. If you come from a divorced family, they ask you about your custodial parent, but not your non-custodial parent. I mean, if you really wanted to figure this out, I mean, it's a very long and complicated form, but even that long and complicated form, it doesn't really figure it out. So it's complicated. It's not perfect. It's better than nothing. It gives us a lot of information, but it's not perfect. And one of the principles that's behind it is that in sort of a long-time principle of financial aid is that you take people as they are. In other words, you don't say, okay, first of all, we don't ask for, you know, 18 years of tax forms. We just ask for last year. So we don't say, so how long have you been making $50,000 a year? Did you make $200,000 a year ago? And if you've been making all this money, like, have you saved anything for college? Or, you know, we don't ask questions about why you are where you are. We don't, if you have two parents and one of them works and the other one doesn't, we don't say, if you really want to go to college, how come that parent's not working? We just say, here you are, this is what you have. And so we're talking about ability to pay, and the contrast that's frequently made between need-based aid and non-need-based aid is need-based aid is ability to pay. We want to know, can you pay? And merit aid, it's like this recruiting issue. It's, we know you could pay, but what you're saying to us is, if you don't make it cheaper for me, I'm not coming to Madison. I'm going to go to Ann Arbor instead. You want me to come here? You know, what's your offer? That's my willingness to pay, right? And so there's a lot of financial aid going to people who are able to pay, but they're unwilling to pay for that particular institution. I'm pretty sure they're not unwilling to pay to go to college. None of these people are debating whether to go to college or not. They're debating whether to come to your institution or another institution. And the idea that particularly a public institution, but a private institution, any institution, is spending its money on, you know, trying to influence your decision between College A and College B, the social purpose of that is, as a society, we really don't care whether you go to College A or College B. So why are we doing that if it's willingness to pay? Yeah.
I guess you could argue that doing need-based aid would not encourage families to save for their children's education. It also wouldn't encourage students to earn the grades that they need to get merit-based aid.
Okay,
and so it's not fair to students who have better grades.
So this argument is that if you give need-based aid, it might discourage people from saving to go to college. It might discourage that you want to encourage people to do the hard work and get the grades that they need to go to college. And so you want people to have the money because they deserve it. And you're talking about incentive effects of aid, right? And so that's a really interesting thing if you think about it. So what is ability to pay? Can you really divide ability to pay and willingness to pay? If you really, really want your kid to go to college, then you should save some money in advance, right? So if you didn't save money in advance, and you took your kids to Disney World every summer instead, and now here you are and you're not able to pay, that's ability to pay, or is that willingness to pay? You know, which one is it? Does your willingness to pay affect what you look like on paper and affect how we measure your ability to pay? Can we really draw a line between ability and willingness to pay? If you have two parents, I mean, there are parents who go out and get, you know, a second or a third job when their kids are, you know, so they can save for their kids to go to college, right? And then they look able to pay. Whereas if they say, oh, you know, I don't need to do that, you know, maybe then they look unable to pay, but maybe they're unwilling to pay. So once you start realizing that it's not so easy to draw a line between ability to pay and willingness to pay, it becomes a lot harder to draw that line between giving aid just based on ability to pay and taking willingness to pay into consideration. So, you know, I mean, again, I don't mean to be suggesting that I think, you know, these two, ability to pay and willingness to pay, are equal, or that we should not differentiate between them in allocating aid. But it's not so simple. It's not that one is totally right and one is totally wrong, because there just isn't a clear line between those things. And you suggested that there are some reasons why we actually might want to either provide incentives for students to do well in school or give rewards for that, right? And this is a big argument. You know, a number of states have merit-based aid policies where, so for example, if you go to high school in Georgia, is anybody here from Georgia? If you go to high school in Georgia, you know that if you get a B average, you can go to state university for free because you're going to get a Georgia Hope scholarship. Which means that everybody basically at the University of Georgia, nobody's paying tuition, because if you could get into the University of Georgia, you had to have that kind of a grade point average, and now it's free. And when they started doing this, there were a lot more car sales in Georgia because parents were saying to their kids, oh, now we don't have to pay tuition, we'll buy you a car if you'll go to the University of Georgia instead of going someplace else, right? Now, is that the intent? So lots of question about, are students now working harder in high school? Maybe. Is the grade inflation? Maybe. So everybody will have a B average. You know, what's the right thing to do here? But, and should we reward students? Well, maybe getting into the University of Georgia is your reward. Like, you're not going to get in if you don't do well, right? So the best, the most selective colleges don't do this because the reward, they understand, is getting into this institution. But that's a kind of debate that exists, and people use this argument, we have to reward this behavior as, you know, that's what's fair. It's not fair. I have a smart kid. They did really well in school, and my kid didn't get financial aid, and your kid was like an average student, and your kid's getting financial aid. That's not fair. And the word fair is absolutely used in that context, and obviously there are differences of opinion about it. But what really is disturbing, I think, to most people about giving the money to people who don't need it is that there isn't enough money to go around. Like, if we had enough money for everybody, and then there's money left over, and at some colleges and universities that is the case, then you want to give the money to the best students. That's a different argument, right? I mean, what is the reason why we bristle at the idea that public universities are giving money to people who could afford to come without it? Because there are other people who don't have enough money, right? That's why it's disturbing. But, you know, that's not necessarily the case all the time, right? So we really have to ask, if that's the problem, are we sure about that? So I put Rawls's name up here because I'm assuming there are lots of philosophers in the room and everybody knows who John Rawls is, but maybe everybody doesn't. I won't ask you to raise your hand if you don't know. But so I'm going to give a very simple two-sentence sort of explanation, and Harry's going to cover his ears so I don't violate too much the actual, you know, John Rawls. But basically, so John Rawls was a philosopher whom economists have looked to quite a bit as sort of somebody who came up with a simple way of defining what's fair, that we could actually start defining public policies that would be based on a Rawlsian notion of what's fair. And a basic idea is that what you need to do is worry about the well-being of the people at the bottom. And a policy is fair if it makes people at the bottom better off. So in a way, it's like what you should do is you should start and make those people better off, and don't start worrying about making other people better off. Worry about bringing the people at the bottom up. Inequality is not always wrong, though. Inequality is okay if and only if it helps the people at the bottom. So should you just take away from the top and give everything to people at the bottom, and then you'd be making the people at the bottom better off, right? But, I mean, there's some obvious, like, what if we just took all lots and lots of money away from people at the top and gave it all to people at the bottom? What would the problem be? Be in practical terms. Yeah.
It would create a disincentive to work harder.
It would create a disincentive to work harder. Okay, so people who could go out and make $1 million a year, if you said, well, you only get to keep 10,000, they might think it's not worth it. Now, some people can make $1 million a year without working too hard, right? So they might go ahead and do it anyway. But yeah, I mean, the pie might shrink, right? So there's that basic concept that you can't just keep, you can't necessarily level everything off. So does that apply, is there any way to apply that in a sort of microcosm to what would happen, what happens with financial aid? So when we talk about financial aid, a lot of times people are thinking about, you know, what's Harvard doing with its financial aid, or what's a wealthy public institution like Wisconsin doing with its financial aid. But, you know, a lot of the financial aid and a lot of these decisions are happening at private colleges around the country that don't have very much money. And so, I mean, if you look at the endowments of private colleges, there are a few that have huge endowments, and then there are many, 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 many that have tiny, tiny, tiny endowments, and they really don't have very much money. And these colleges that aren't very rich, they actually educate a lot of students who aren't very rich. So if you look at the Ivy League, they have just a few affluent students, whereas a lot of private colleges have a lot of private students, a lot of poor students, and they don't have enough money to meet the need of all of these students. And they just don't have enough money to do a lot of the things that they want to do. So what are they going to do? And they really face a very difficult problem. And if they don't bring in some students who bring money to campus, they're not going to be able to operate. And they just don't have enough funds to do that. So if they started at the bottom and met the need of all of the lowest income students, of which they have many, they would run out of money really quickly, and then they wouldn't have any money to operate. So maybe what they need to do is do something a little bit more strategic and bring in some students from wealthier families who actually can afford to pay, and, you know, even if they give them a discount, I mean, if you give it to them for free, then that's not going to do the trick, right? But if you give them a discount and then they come to campus and other people like them come to campus, you might have more money, you might be able to have a better educational program, and you might be able to use some of that money for need-based aid for lower-income students. You might make the pie bigger. So really, when you think about what goes on many of these college campuses, that's what's going on. It's not necessarily that you're taking money out of the pockets of the lowest income students. In some cases you are, but not in every case. It's a much more complicated problem than that. And it's really easier to stand back and say, oh, this is the wrong thing to do, how could you do this, than it is to be in the situation and think about how you're actually going to create educational opportunities with limited resources for a wide variety of people. So, again, more complicated issues. Meeting full need is a complicated issue, too. What does it mean to meet full need? Like, some colleges say they meet full need, and then they give everybody a $15,000 loan. Is that meeting full need? Or do you have to give everybody grant aid to meet full need? And we said before, we don't actually know how to define need that well. So just one more, thinking about these no-loan promises, because many of you may have heard that, so this was like this, people are very worried about student loans. I don't know how many of you have student loans, but if you look at the headlines, the standard headline is students are drowning in debt, we should be panicked, it's outrageous, students are borrowing too much money. Some students are borrowing too much money, but going to college is an investment in yourself, you're going to earn more money as a result, pretty reasonable thing to borrow money for. But nonetheless, a concern to many students, and some of the richer colleges, starting with Princeton, but Princeton and Yale and Harvard and Williams and Dartmouth and a lot of schools said, okay, either nobody has to borrow money or low-income students don't have to borrow money. And as I said, they said that before the economy collapsed. So now, and the question becomes, should they keep their promise? So if I say, what's the ethical thing to do? Do you keep your promises? Yeah. But now, Williams College was the first, Williams and Dartmouth, I think, are the two that have said, we can no longer afford to keep that promise. So what do we think about that? Are they doing the right thing? Are they doing the wrong thing? And I don't know in the context specifically of Williams College whether they're doing the right thing, but I do know that if you think about it, think about the idea, these are students, I mean, if you're going to Dartmouth or Williams and you end up graduating with $15,000 or $20,000 of debt, you're probably going to be just fine. But if there's a finite budget, and if they promise that nobody is going to have to borrow money, then that means that somebody else isn't going to get in or isn't going to get any money. I mean, something's got to happen. I mean, is that right? Is that the right thing to do to make sure that people don't borrow? And a bigger question is, what did that do to the general sense of borrowing money for college? If you read headlines all the time that say, we are doing the right thing for students, we are making sure that they can go to college without borrowing, and you are a student who, like most students in the United States, doesn't get into Harvard or Williams or Dartmouth. You're going to go to a different college where a lot of people have to borrow money. Does that, what do you think? Do you think if I were better, I wouldn't have to borrow money? If the college were good, I wouldn't have to borrow money. This must be bad for me to borrow money. And if students refuse to borrow money, then there are a lot of problems, some of which Mike's going to talk about in a minute, about, you know, will they work too much? Will they not be able to graduate? Will they not go to college because they think they can't afford it and they don't want to borrow the money? So again, I don't have an answer to that question. It's just not a simple question about whether that's the right thing to do or not the right thing to do. So basically, like, these are examples of where equity and efficiency might not be totally contradictory. People are always talking about the trade-off between equity and efficiency, and Arthur Oaken many, many years ago talked about this leaky bucket where, you know, how much equity can you buy? How much equity do you want to buy? How much efficiency do you want to give up? You can't just transfer a dollar from here to there. You're going to lose some of it. What's the trade-off? But many of the decisions that we have to make, there really isn't such a trade-off. Many times, what's fair and what's equitable may be the same thing. I mean, in education, obviously, it's fair for us to provide educational opportunities to people, but it's also efficient because we're wasting our resources if we don't. And that's going to be true in the decisions that we make on college campuses as well, that it's not necessarily the most equitable thing just to say, we are going to do all those things that sound on the surface like the right thing to do. Because if we do all of those things, we might not have any money left, and we might not be able to actually offer quality educational opportunities. So how do we make decisions about what are the right things to do? And I think that so the point I want to make is that the first step is to realize, one, that there are a lot of questions like this. Two, that we have to ask the ethical questions. We can't just say, what's the bottom line on the budget? But we can't assume that what looks like the fair thing to do is necessarily, given all of the constraints that we face, going to be the fair thing to do. And I think that it can give us more patience with decision makers if we understand that they can't always do the thing that looks superficially like the fair thing, but it also can make us more demanding of decision makers in terms of insisting that the justification for what they do can't just be the bottom line, because there are multiple ways to get to that bottom line, and some of them have are more acceptable ethically than others. And so what we have to do is we have to really sort of state this all up front, and we have to talk about the fact that these decisions are complicated and that there really are ethical implications to those decisions. So there are lots of other examples to use, but I think the main point that I want to make is that we all have to take a step back, and whether we're on the side of let's be equitable or on the side of let's be efficient, we have to realize that the people on the other side have something to say, and we're probably thinking about this much too simplistically if we think we have the right answers.
Well, I too am very happy to be here, and happy that so many of you found on what seems to be quite a lovely day, as dearly as I can tell, took this opportunity to be with us. I wanted to say one remark about Sandy's theme. I had an opportunity this summer to see Sandy give a talk that was on similar lines. Harry was there as well. To an audience that was mainly higher education officials from a wide variety of campuses. And I think one of the things that comes home to me is that it is indeed the case that when you think about the real world choices that leaders have to make, that the ethical dilemmas are complex and right answers are not as easy to come by as one might think. On the other hand, I think a big value added for encouraging leaders to think through with somebody like Sandy the ethical trade-offs that are involved in the choices they're making is to encourage them to perceive the ethical dimension of the problem, which is really different from convincing them that there is a right answer, but getting them to recognize, like, so if you made a promise last year, the best thing to do they might assume from both a moral point of view and maybe more importantly a public relations point of view is not to go back on it. But if keeping that promise, as Sandy said, implies that you are going to do in some other part of the program, which may be on balance more important morally for you to do, then stepping up and taking the embarrassment of saying, we were not in a position to make that promise because we didn't actually understand our investments as well as we thought we did. And we're really, really sorry about that. Believe me, they're really, really sorry about that. But they have to face up to it. So the more I think we can engage leaders in these kinds of conversations and sort of improve their moral awareness without preaching to them that we have all the right answers, I think we can do well. See if I can tell the difference between up and down. Am I going up or down? I'm going the right direction. So I'm one of these people right at the end of this effort. I want to talk about a closely related subject. You know, in a sense, what Sandy was describing for the most part and what has gotten the most policy attention by far in this country is the question of crossing the starting line into college. And for a lot of leaders, as well as a lot of families, success is understood as making it into college, particularly for disadvantaged families where nobody in the family has been to college. It is indeed a signal achievement to be the first in your family to go to college. Parents are proud, grandparents are proud, neighbors are proud. It's a great thing to do. But it is only the start. And if all you do is cross the starting line and then stumble out of the game, you haven't really accomplished very much. And we haven't, in a policy sense, given nearly as much attention to the question of what is it that leads some groups to get across the finish line so much more effectively than others do. Bill Bowen, former president of Princeton, former president of the Mellon Foundation, Matt Chingos, a truly brilliant and talented young researcher who was working with Bill and I, put together a study which depended on having a number of universities and colleges, public ones, share the data on all the individual students who entered as freshmen in the year 1999. Now, Wisconsin actually is one of those places, Wisconsin at Madison. And I wonder if there's anybody here who was a freshman at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1999. Because if there is, I'm going to go look you up. No, actually, I can't do that. Actually, we never had the names of individual students. Believe me, we never did. Honest, don't tell the chancellor I made that joke, or we are toast. We never had that information. But it was wonderful that we had such a rich set of data. We had 21 flagship public universities, and for four states, every public institution in the system. And that included the, you know, if you thought about Wisconsin, that would include all of the University of Wisconsin campuses, of which there are a number, and other public institutions as well. So we had a picture of both these big influential places, which teach a lot of students, and of these systems by which students get sorted. What I want to do is, I have talked about this book a lot, and in fact, I gave a talk to the University of Wisconsin Regents for this system in the fall, which I think was well received, and I was very impressed with how seriously the Regents seemed to be taking this crossing the finish line problem. What I want to do is dilate a little bit, for the most part, after some background information, on a problem that I honestly don't think we have completely thought through in the book, and that I don't think I have completely thought through right now. And this will be an opportunity to help me kind of clarify my own thinking and maybe invite some help from all of you. But first, some basic background. These are not data from our particular students. These are national data on bachelor's degree attainment by, I think it's age 35, if I remember correctly, according to parental educational status and parental family income by quartile. And it is truly dramatic if you look at people who entered college, and they're probably, these are not people who entered college, these are simply starting with people in the American society what is the probability you're going to have a bachelor's degree by this age, depending on your background? Less than 1 in 10 if you're from the bottom of the income distribution and nobody from your family had gone to college. More than 2 out of 3 if you're from the top of the income distribution and at least one of your parents is a college graduate. I mean, that is a stunning degree of inequality, and it's a degree of inequality that has its roots right in the beginning of people's lives. These gaps, which are the result of complex social structures, start emerging very early. They stop a lot of people from getting through high school. They send a lot of people to colleges where they don't have a chance, a very good chance of getting a degree. And then the people who do get to colleges where they have a good chance of getting a degree face a number of obstacles along the way. That adds up to tremendous inequality in our society. Now, we tried to take those numbers apart, and we tried to look carefully at individual histories and individual background information, including test scores, college, high school grades, and other kinds of information. I'm not going to try to go through all of that. I really want to zero in on one particular phenomenon which we thought deserved a lot more attention than it had gotten in most past work. We were very influenced by some excellent work on this exact subject that had been done by a group at the University of Chicago, looking at Chicago public school students and their probabilities of college attainment. This is the problem of what we came to call undermatching. What you want to think of in terms of this chart, these are B selectivity institutions, cell B institutions, are less selective. This is from the states where we had data on all the students in the public systems. And the select A institutions are the flagships or the places that are close to flagships in those four states. What we have on the left are students who undermatched by going to a less selective institution when their credentials would have gotten them into a more selective institution. So these are students who had the test scores and the grades to have a very good probability, like a 2/3 probability of being admitted, let's say, to UW-Madison. We only had data on Madison, so this is a made-up comparison. It's not in our data. But instead of going to UW-Madison, they went to UW-Whitewater, let's say. Nothing against Whitewater, but it's one whose name I know because I grew up in Wisconsin. These are students with the same qualifications as the students over here who went to the more selective institution. Now, for the group on the left, the probability of graduating within 4 years is 44%, and it's 66% within 6 years. For those on the right, same qualifications, the probability of graduating is 59% in 4 years and 81% in 6 years. That's a quite significant difference based on the choice they made about where to go. This is not a question of admissions policies of the colleges. These are students who, according to their own admissions policies, would be admitted if they applied. This is basically a problem of students not applying to these places. So that, we think, is worth some attention. Now, how likely are you to undermatch? Well, we looked at that, again, according to the family incomes of the folks involved and according to the educational backgrounds of the folks involved. So this is pretty interesting, I would say. If you're from the top quartile of the income distribution, or if you have highly educated parents, there's a very good chance you will have figured this out. You have, in the case of the top quartile people, only about 1 in 4 undermatch. 1 in 4 miss the boat, in terms of going to the most challenging place that they could likely get into. But if you're at the bottom of these distributions, if you're coming from a family with no college experience, nobody who graduated from college in the family, you have about 2 chances in 3 almost of undershooting in terms of where you go to college. And when you undershoot in terms of where you go to college, the odds that you're going to graduate are distinctly lower. Now, we can talk about the whys of these things, and we don't have direct evidence about why. So the social science study that we did gives a lot of evidence about the whats, but as is frustratingly true for so much social science, it doesn't really open up the mechanisms in as deep a way as we'd like. Yeah?
For the undermatching data, is it based on where they actually start going to school or where they graduate from school? So if someone decides to go to a community college for the first 2 years to get rid of their general education requirements, and then their junior year decide to go to a flagship public institution, are they considered undermatching for the first 2 years?
Well, I'm gonna show you a slide that looks specifically at the 2-year, 4-year question in a minute. Let me just say that for a student who enters a 4-year institution with a 2-year degree, their odds of completing are very good. There's a big question about the likelihood that the strategy of beginning at a 2-year and clearing that hurdle and getting to the 4-year will actually occur. Now, in these data, these are actually all people who were started at 4-year institutions. But if you look at 2-year institutions, we have here data for white students. We have a graph that you couldn't tell a difference if it was black students or if it was students of Hispanic origin. And this shows a distribution of students across the bottom axis and the probability of winding up with a bachelor's degree on the vertical axis. These propensity scores, basically, they're ranking people according to the likelihood that they would start at a 2-year college, which is roughly the same as ranking them according to their qualifications. So what you could think of is the people on the left start out with a good prospect of success, and the people on the right start out with a much weaker prospect of success, mainly because they have lower test scores and high school grades. But what you see throughout is that there is a dramatic difference in the likelihood of crossing the finish line, depending on where you start. Really a dramatic difference. So even these people who have all the marks of the sort of people who start at 4-year colleges, if they do start a 4-year college, they're like 90% odds of graduating. If they started a 2-year college, they have just about a 50% graduating prospect. People down here who have a lesser chance of getting into a 4-year college in the first place and a lesser chance of getting through, if they do start there, they have, again, almost a 50% chance. But they have well under a 20% chance if they start at a 2-year college. That in the systems we looked at directly, we found that the 2-year colleges have such a low retention rate, such a low probability of completing their program. And in the case of North Carolina, which we looked at with particular intensity and where these data are from, these were all full-time students who had taken the SAT. So these are people who could seriously claim to have been aiming at a BA. We weren't conflating those with adults who were getting, you know, part-time courses in vocational training. So if you have a friend who is contemplating college and weighing that choice, based on these data, you would want to tell your friend to start at a 4-year college, right? Before I get to your question, I want to make a qualification here. People in Wisconsin have contended to me that the Wisconsin system is rather different from most states. There is a kind of separate set of 2-year feeder campuses, and then there are community technical colleges, which do a lot of the stuff which is also done along with the feeder purpose at the other colleges. And they say it works much better. And I say, let me have the data, we'll do the study. And it, they may well be right. I don't mean to dismiss that as a possibility. But people's objective impressions of how well they're doing are imperfectly correlated with what the data tell you about how well they're doing. And they will readily tell you they don't have the data organized in this way. I'm sorry. Thank you for your patience. Yeah.
I'm assuming that the criteria are quantitative.
Yes.
In nature by score and GPA and things like that.
Right.
Okay, I just want.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah. They're the things we could measure in this data set. There is, you know, always the possibility that there are some underlying secret things that people know about themselves that they would actually be failures if they went to four-year colleges. You can't completely eliminate that possibility except through a random control study, and we're going to do a random control study in Chicago. But the fact is that if those secret things were equally present in different populations, you wouldn't see so much less undermatching among more affluent people, right? So it's that, that gives you some reason for doubt that you can explain this away with a selection effect. And this is pretty damn big, too. I mean, selection effects are important. They're never to be brushed aside. But I would not, they don't give me too much doubt about this. There have been other studies, particularly the two-year, four-year thing. Locke Reynolds has a very well-controlled study that found quite similar results for California. Yeah?
In the earlier slide, how are you getting parent education and income? Are you using census matching? Because it's not on most applications except for FAFSA people.
We have parent education application. We have that information for a subset of students, and we do inferential matching for others, for education and income. We also have
first generation data. Mm-hmm. You certainly don't have family income data.
We also have a self-reported family income from ACT because in ACT and SAT, we match to ACT and SAT.
But that's student.
That's a student. Yeah, this is not perfect. You know, if you know of any perfect data sets, give me a call. This was the best data set we could put together. And I would not claim perfection for it. So here's what I want to dilate on a little bit. Everything I'm about to say attempts to push beyond what we actually have in the book. Why do students undermatch? We do in the book try to think as well as we can about the causes of this phenomenon. And I put it here in a series of questions that parents and students might ask themselves. Can we really afford this? I mean, do I want my daughter to apply to the University of Wisconsin-Madison and then tell her, well, I'm glad you got in, honey, but you know, you're not going to be able to go. I would rather avoid that disappointment. Does it matter where I go? You know, I don't know anybody who graduated from college, except the teachers at the local school my kid went to. Let me put it in parents' language. And they didn't go to any place fancy. You know, the big thing is to graduate. You know, where you go, not so important. People in the top quartile of the income distribution don't believe that for a second. And of course, the fact that the probability of completing differs substantially is a big reason to care about this. But there's no reason why, if you're not wired into this system, you would know that. Will I feel comfortable? A lot of young people in urban parts of Chicago have never set foot on any college campus except a community college campus. They may have driven by Northwestern, and they see it as big buildings, a lot of greenery, and at most universities, almost no signs even to tell you where to go. These are places that are full of secret codes, that are full of tacit knowledge, like course catalogs. You know, go ahead, Johnny, choose your courses for your freshman year. Johnny's never been asked to choose anything about his education in the first 18 years of his life. Is he going to know what's going on? Is there going to be anybody there who looks like him, who dresses like him, who doesn't have a car, who, you know, et cetera, et cetera? Maybe they won't feel comfortable if they show up, but if they don't have an opportunity to learn about what the life is actually like and find out how welcoming or unwelcoming the campus is, they're not going to have a chance to choose. And then I think a big one for some families, and some people suggest that particularly in the Hispanic community, the question of why can't you stay nearby where on the one hand we can protect you, and on the other hand, you can help us. Why do you have to go away? Well, these are serious concerns, and we think that some of them can be addressed to some degree. And what my own view really is it's not the right choice for everybody to go to the most demanding place they can get into, but everybody should be able to make that choice with an understanding of its significance. And that's what we would like to work on. So can we afford it? Partly people don't understand how financial aid works. Now, it's a complex matter even at the best of times, but we are far from being in the best of times. And for families in urban school districts with one advisor for 500 students, you know, they're not going to get a ton of guidance help at the school. I know Bob Haveman has been thinking very actively about how can you make it real to people that they can actually afford to go. A lot of people are very afraid of debt. They watch programs like 2020, which try to gain audience by scaring the crap out of people and discouraging them from making these efforts, as Sandy knows by firsthand experience of appearing on 2020. And in fact, a reasonable amount of debt is a perfectly reasonable thing to undertake for an extremely valuable investment, but they may not know about it. And, you know, look, sometimes people will be asked to make very difficult choices, and they may decide to say no. You know, I'm going to try the challenging path of the two-year college and then the transfer. But they should know that the probabilities they're going to execute that path are quite limited. The comfort thing, I think universities have a hugely great distance to cover in addressing this question. Morty Shapiro, who is now the president of Northwestern, likes to say that universities pride themselves on being tolerant. But nobody wants to be tolerated, right? That's not what it's about. Everybody wants to feel they own the place where they're going. And we all, I used to be a college president, we've all worked at trying to make our places like that. But we could be much more effective at that than we are. Why can't our daughter stay close? You know, you do have to think about that young woman's future, and you need to understand what price she may be paying in order to serve a role which is of great importance to you and helps you know that you're of great importance to her and make an honest decision about that. So we think it's possible to have an impact on this if enough resources are put into getting information to people in a timely, effective way. A couple of questions here. Yeah. Please, please.
You know, you mentioned the importance of what is the each institutional does to keep their students. And
yeah.
In terms of socioeconomic background and the differences in educational attainment anyway, I mean, the government knew about it in the 60s from the Coleman Report, and that's why all this trio program started,
yeah.
You know, to support students from low-income families and first-generation college students. But no matter how much we do to try to supplement, in an institutional such as this, we're not successful. I have to say, because our graduation rate is not the same as majority students.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, in terms of future research, is there anything that you think you could do that would be so more than on the students themselves.
Well, I agree. It shouldn't all be on the students themselves. It should be on the institutions. And, well, I'll tell you, we had really hoped that in our rich data set, some huge success stories would leap out at us. They don't. You know, I think it's just really, really hard work. The most obvious thing is that people need to get this, people who help run these institutions need to get this issue into their forebrains. And if they can think about it and persistently pursue it and try things and share what they learn from what they try, it's the kind of thing that I think we can get better at, but it's really difficult. I also think it's a demanding standard to say that you should have the same rate for students from disadvantaged backgrounds as for other students. It's the right thing to aim at, but I would be very confident that the probability of those students graduating at Madison is a lot higher than it would be at the alternative places that they would attend. So you shouldn't lose sight of the fact that relative to their alternatives, this is a successful option, even though it's not as good as it needs to be. So I want to turn next, and I hope briefly, to a dilemma that actually Dan Hausman helped me focus on clearly early on. And I don't think it's adequately, we don't claim to have focused on it clearly in the book. We learned a lot from doing this study, and it gives us some confidence that we can offer advice to folks based on what we found out. It's really easy to know what advice to give to a disadvantaged family, right? I mean, it's just not, you know, if you actually know somebody personally, and many of us do, and you have an opportunity to say, you know, look, this person has the credentials to get into a place which will also give good aid, and is weighing the choice of that and the nearby community college where he wants to stay because all his friends are going there. You know what to say, right? If the person is seriously concerned about their future. To a school district like Chicago's, where we're hoping to do some work with a heavy concentration of low-income students, we know what to say for their students. They have done a great job in Chicago of getting students over the hurdle of going to college. They've got practically everybody, more than 80% filling out the FAFSA form, which is great. They have people, everybody takes the ACT in the state of Wisconsin. They're doing a lot, and they get a lot of that. They aren't nearly as far along on being able to give any kind of guidance about where you should aim at, and they just don't know enough to be able to do that. And unambiguously, I think, from a moral point of view, students should have that information so they can make the choice. But now, harder question. Suppose you changed this world in a significant way. Suppose you actually had a lot of success in moving a lot of students from disadvantaged backgrounds into the environment of these more selective colleges. And this became a big thing, right, quantitatively. What are the implications of that happening? Now, I'm not staying up worrying about this happening anytime in the near future, like the rest of my life. But as a policy analyst, we should be able to think about the consequences of system-level change. Now, the easiest one to think about, and in some ways the most comforting, and maybe the most likely, is that the total number of slots in selective institutions doesn't go up. Just imagine you get more good applications from disadvantaged students, and you're blessed with enough financial capacity, or the federal government's financing and the state's financing are enough to allow those students to pay enough of the bills to be admitted. More of those students get in. Therefore, if they don't expand, some of those students with more money and lower credentials get out. I'm cool with that. I don't think that's a social loss. They will have many more resources to draw on in coping with the challenges of going to a less selective institution. It's a misfortune for them, for sure, and believe me, politically, a lot of people will hear about this if this happens in a serious way. But that's fine. That won't be my problem. But what if the selective schools do expand? And, you know, it's interesting. Amherst recently decided that they were going to enroll 100 more low-income students. And originally, they were just going to say, we're going to make greater efforts to get low-income students to our campus. And the trustees resisted. Why? Because the probability of the children of the friends of the trustees getting in would go down. So Amherst expanded by 100 students and said, we'll make those low-income students. So you could see a story in which the total capacity of the selective part of the system expands. Now, in itself, that seems attractive. It's an increase in opportunities. But where is the money going to come from for that expansion to take place? Well, is it going to come from putting less funding into the unselective institutions where the students who didn't have those good test scores wind up? Is that going to result in those students having even worse prospects as a result? That's not a very Rawlsian outcome, because the fact is that the students we're going to help are not going to be the worst off, right? They're going to be the ones who have the capacity to do good things. So if you start thinking about this, you have to say, well, what has to happen here? What we have to do is take the state of Wisconsin. If we do this in a serious way, we have to take one of these other campuses and make it more like Madison. I can safely assume Madison's the best because you're all at Madison. And then what's going to happen to the students who will no longer get into that place that they were at before? Right? You need an answer to that question. We don't have an answer to that question. Our book doesn't have an answer to that question. The full policy implications of working through this thought experiment, including figuring out how big the numbers are altogether that could be produced by this effect, that's a very interesting project in my view. And then there is, to use a phrase which apparently has been banned entirely from the lexicon in Washington, who no longer, all they're talking about is ESEA reauthorization. The phrase No Child Left Behind is just gone completely. There are going to be students left behind by this policy. They are going to be even more intensely in an environment where they don't have strong peers. This is tracking, right? Tracking is, of course, a very familiar phenomenon of higher education. This is nothing new. This is an intensification of tracking. Now, in my view, to say we should keep some low-income students back in these schools to serve as better models for the low-income students who don't have the capacity to get out is appallingly exploitive. You can't do that. I'd much rather put rich kids in those schools and let them be the role models who are heading to the west side of Chicago every day for their education. A consequence of giving those kids more opportunity, which they have earned and deserve, may well be to worsen the education of those who are left behind. What do we owe them? You know, maybe what we actually have to do is make Madison, forgive me, a little less wealthy. I know that's a hard thing even for you to imagine these days. And make some of these places where kids really don't have very good prospects, but where that's where they're going to be, a little better. Or maybe we need to have more imagination about thinking about what are really good options for people who don't really have the promise of an academic success. You know, do we just say, congratulations, we're going to give you an opportunity for academic failure? Or do we think about, are there other paths into lives that they will find successful other than conventional college lives? These are big questions. I think it's a mark of a good study that asks hard questions that it doesn't have the answers to. But if any of you has the answers, I'd be happy to co-author a book with you. Okay, Sandy and I will leave it there. I think we have time for questions.